word is true. It's the biggest entertainment that ever hit the screen with laughter.
It's the whole shocking story of Hollywood ripped bare for the first time. All Mixed Up with Peter Beauchamp. Monday mornings at 9:30 here on WBAI.
On the April 21st edition of the Caribbean and Latin America Report, a preview of the upcoming elections in Panama and Colombia. Who are the candidates, the political parties, and what are they proposing for these two countries, both of which have been in a state of crisis for some time? Who is supporting singer Ruben Blades, and what is he proposing for Panama? All this, as well as the regional news update. That's Thursday, April 21st, 10 o'clock p.m. on the Caribbean and Latin America Report, right here on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM.
And this is radio station WBAI. It's 10 o'clock. Time for Off the Hook. Well, every now and then it's good to let the whole theme play out, and that's what we did. This is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on another Wednesday night. And one thing we're going to do tonight is continue the discussion we started last week, because it was just such a lively discussion about software piracy, and that's something that I know is on people's minds. So when it's on people's minds, it's a good idea to continue with that. But we also have a couple of other fun facts to pass along. Including some stories from around the world, which you might find humorous, interesting, tragic, funny, what have you. Here's something that I think is important for all of us to know about. This is something that came out of Holland only a couple of days ago. This letter is dated March 28th, but it's only just beginning to be felt over here. It concerns something that the Dutch government is doing, and they don't really want it to be known by very many people. So we're going to disobey that directive right here and let people know what's going on. This comes from a gentleman named Wim Sonnemans, who I hope I haven't gotten into trouble by mentioning his name, but I don't think so, because this is being passed around over on the Internet, and this is something that needs to be spread around even more. In his words, a news flash from Holland. The Dutch Department of Justice has pressed for legislation on encryption. A parliamentary committee is currently working on a proposal that would effectively outlaw possession, use, trade of encryption devices. That's right, the next step, making it all illegal. Remember, we've talked about this. First comes Clipper, and then once nobody uses Clipper, well, how do you enforce it? You make the rest of it illegal. Well, seems like in Holland they're jumping to that already, which is very interesting. Continuing here, the committee is constructing a proposal which would tie a license to use of government-approved encryption devices. The proposal is prepared in secrecy, but some details have already leaked. Supposedly, anyone who is caught using encryption on a telephone line is fined and loses his telephone connection for 3 days. Your worst nightmare is becoming our reality. And what makes it worse, the work on the proposal has kept a low profile to avoid public discussions on the matter. A member of the press interviewed some members of parliament on the pre-proposal. One didn't know what it was about. The other one knew something but stated that it did not interest him. Here in Holland, the public awareness concerning encryption is very low. Unlike in the United States, the use of computers in the home is not that common. We'll have a hard time convincing our parliament to thoroughly evaluate any proposal concerning encryption that might be introduced. Assisting the parliament with the technical expertise to get them to truly understand encryption and the implications of legislation will be our main goal. Well, it's a pretty scary scenario there, and something that we need to pass along so people see that this is a multi-step process. It's not just a theory that things like encryption will be outlawed someday. This is something that is very much on the agenda of a lot of governments, a lot of people in control. I'm sure a lot of people within our own government would like to see us troublemakers not have the ability to encrypt things with our own algorithms and our own way of doing things. It's part of the simplistic way of looking at a problem, or perhaps creating a problem where one does not already exist. So that's something to spread around on the net as much as possible. I also have, a bit of an apology that I'd like to communicate. I'm sorry that I dissed Atari computers last week. It's, I've gotten a bit of flack for doing that, and, I guess I'm just not all that familiar with them. I've never actually played with an Atari computer, and I guess also I've fallen victim to not having seen them around all that much, assuming that they're just not all that great. Well, of course, that's not a very good way to look at things, especially from my point of view. I'd like to read to you part of one of the letters that we received from somebody who's out on Long Island. I won't give the name because I don't know if they want us to give the name. I was listening to your BAI broadcast last Wednesday, where you said in passing that Atari computers are dead. Well, that's a pity, because you would have liked the maverick, decentralized ethos of the Atari world. Unlike the corporate hierarchies of IBM, Microsoft, and the high yuppie heirs of the Mac, you had an Atari, a machine that runs better than the others and on software from around the world, Germany, France, the UK, Canada, even the US, in most all cases from singular code heads operating out of bedrooms or tiny storefronts, making up for the incompetence of corporate owners with software which was in many cases better and in all cases much cheaper than the major CompuCore, and you could call up the guy who wrote it if you had a problem. It was a small world, this, as you say, dead Atari realm. Funny thing, though, you're kind of wrong. The Atari world, really a small ghetto without borders, is still alive. For example, I'm writing this on an Atari TT, which runs as fast as a 486 and much cleaner than the lard-bottomed IBM architecture, and next month a $100 piece of software from Germany is promised to boost its speed past the 486 to 64 megahertz. I'm typing this note on a Zeos IBM standard keyboard with a word processor called Le Redacteur, which was developed in France for the journalists of the newspaper Libération. It's faster, smarter, and much more elegant than Mormon Word Perfect. Yeah, and the printout you hold in your hand was generated by a 2P LaserJet 4 600 DPI printer. Actually, it was a fax, and it was faxed through my super modem. No matter, my point is that the Atari world is, in its fashion, quite alive, and more to the point, its marginal, decentralized, non-multinational existence would, I think, appeal to you, given your interest and approach in 2600 and on WBAI, and very correct as far as that kind of thing goes. It's exactly the kind of thing that I guess we need more of, and perhaps its lack of visibility is a symptom of the disease. Who knows? All right, we have this promotional item from it's kind of like a survey. Well, I'll read you what was left in our mailbox. Fed up with excessive utility rates. Now you can fight back. Dear friend, you and millions of other New Yorkers New York citizens, that is, have to suffer from some of the worst electric and phone rates in the country. Before now, you just had to take it, but now you can do something. You can join with other citizens in the New York Citizens Utility Board, known as CUB. CUB was founded to give consumers like you a voice in determining what are fair rates for your electric and phone service. Through CUB, you will be able to fight back against unfair utility rates and push the electric and phone companies to refund the money they owe you when you and other New York consumers are illegally overcharged on your bills. CUBs in other states, with the backing of their members, have brought down rates, saved billions of dollars in canceled rate hikes, and have won millions of dollars in refunds for consumers. Now CUB can do the same for New York, but you must help. The utilities have many millions of dollars to fight for rate increases, much of it taken from your wallet through unfair rates. CUB relies solely on the generosity of individuals such as you. Fight back against your unfair electric and phone rates by joining CUB today. And complete with a suggested list of donations. Not really sure how effective this is. There's a survey here, though, that's included on this piece of paper. I would have to say this is kind of a slanted survey. Please answer the following questions concerning your utility service and charges. Question number one, do you believe that it's fair that New York utility companies are allowed to charge you with some of the highest bills in the nation? Well, how would you answer a question like that? Yes, no, or undecided? I don't know, it's a toss-up. Number two, do you think it's fair that you may be charged up to 70% more than the national average for your phone service? Oh, yeah. That's an easy one. Number three, are you fed up with unfair electric and phone rates? Now, I'm fed up with the fair ones. The unfair ones I don't have a problem with. But in any event, all seriousness, if you want to write to these guys and find out more about them, their address is Citizens Utility Board, 146 Washington Avenue, Albany, New York, 12210. And perhaps this is a way of getting through the bureaucracy and actually having some kind of an intelligent response. Who knows? Oh, you know, speaking of phone companies and intelligent responses and things like that, we told you about the 9X forest last week where they sent out everybody's calling card numbers in a mailing. Well, I got the telegram. I actually found, well, it's not really a telegram, it's a letter from Western Union on behalf of 9X saying that they're really sorry about mailing out the calling cards like that, and that they're dedicated to serving us, and that they'd never let anything like that happen again, and various promises and apologies like that. So I got that, and then a couple of days later I got the original mailing, and sure enough my calling card was printed there. You can look at it by simply folding the handout a little bit and just peering inside it, and you can see the four-digit PIN, and it's very, very simple. You don't even have to open the envelope at all. So that was quite a revelation, something that I'm going to hold on to for posterity. I don't know where it's been all this time, the last couple of weeks, if it's been sitting in the post office, you know, if everybody can copy down the number before it gets sent out, who knows. But I'll be watching my bill to see if there's any fraud on the bill, and I'll know where the weak point is then. But you know what else? 9X has these new envelopes. I don't know if you've seen them. They look just like the New York telephone envelope, same color, and it's what your phone bill comes in. And it says on the bottom left-hand corner, important, your telephone bill is enclosed. But you know what they did? They put this on all of their envelopes so that even when they send you something that is not your phone bill, such as a local itemization list or some other correspondence, it says your telephone bill is enclosed, even when it's not. I mean, this is going to be a great company. I can hardly wait to see what other things are going to happen. This company has only been around now as our phone company for less than 6 months. I mean, they're always the parent company of New York Telephone, but 9X as the entity that you write a check to, that's something brand new. Oh, it's going to be fun. All right, we have a fun story here, and this is a story from India. And I did some digging around, and I was able to actually find some appropriate music from it. I don't know if it's appropriate music, but it's music from India. We'll just have to settle for what we can get. And that's a number of different songs here. So we're just going to have this playing in the background while we tell you about this phone story that comes from India. Fair enough. Let's start with the music.
Hello, Detroit. তন্দের গাড়ি সোনার নদী
I hope that's not too distracting as we read, but we'll see how it goes. This story comes from the Associated Press, and it's entitled, Telephone Torture Sends Politician on Rampage, Operators on Strike. This is a true story about modern India. The villain is the telephone, taken for granted in much of the world, but in India regarded as an instrument of torture. The leading man is a former cabinet minister, once a powerful politician who defied Sikh death threats, but a man humbled by the telephone and a call that wouldn't come through, even at gunpoint. 26 hours and 20 minutes after booking, he got the call. The leading lady is played by hundreds of low-paid, sari-clad, shrieking operators, described by the politician as fat, lazy gossips, drinking tea in a lousy telephone system, the worst in the world. Comparing themselves to Kali, the Hindu goddess of destruction, the operators went on a 3-day wildcat strike. How do you compare yourself to a goddess as you're going on strike? That's something I'd like to know. Smashing switchboards, crippling service, and demanding that the politician, former Home Minister Prakash Shan Sethi, be jailed or held as insane. Some call the telephone melodrama farce, or soap opera, or morality play. The drama has not been played out, but this is how it began. Last Friday at 12:50 a.m., Sethi, a member of parliament, decided enough was enough. He had waited 4 hours and 20 minutes and made 5 pleas to an operator to get a top priority lightning call to Bombay from his home. He warned the operator he was on his way to her office and set off with his son-in-law and 3 armed bodyguards assigned to him because his life had been threatened. He was in charge of domestic security when the army attacked the Sikh's Golden Temple in June of 1984. Sethi took his Czechoslovak-made licensed revolver, explaining later that security rules, quote, require me to hold on to my gun, unquote. Brushing past guards at the downtown exchange, the capital's telephone nerve center, the midnight raiders stormed to the 9th floor and demanded to see the offending operator, Miss Kiran. I am a public man with a grouse, he later said. This place should be thrown open to citizens so they can see what a mess the telephone system is. And that's where accounts start to differ. Miss Kiran said she peeked from the ladies' room and saw a man in a white pajama suit, drunk, staggering, swaggering, and abusive, advancing with 3 guards toward the switchboard. She said she came out and he grabbed her arms, waving his revolver and blowing cigar smoke into her face. Do you know who I am? Do you want to live in this world? Witnesses quoted Sethi as saying, I can buy girls like you for 5 rupees, which is about equivalent to 40 cents. They said a male shop steward interceded, but the 65-year-old Sethi roughed him up and tore his clothes, then collapsed on the floor for 30 minutes. Miss Kiran bolted the exit to keep him there until police arrived. I'll jump from the 9th floor and die, but I will have justice, she told reporters. Police charged Sethi with trespassing, disturbing the peace, using filthy and abusive language, and assaulting a public servant on duty. He was not arrested, though. Sethi says he was petrified when operators surrounded him and wouldn't let him go. Then he says the shop steward knocked him out. He got home at 3:30 a.m. Saturday and says a doctor certified he was not drunk. But about 4,000 operators and staff disputed Sethi's account. By dawn, they launched a strike, demanding his arrest. Domestic and overseas bookings were paralyzed. Some emergency police numbers were dead. Other services were crippled. Women sat atop switchboards, twisted their headsets apart, and shouted, Death to Sethi! Still, Seti's fury struck a responsive chord. India's telephone system is notorious for inefficiency, rude operators, equipment that smacks of bullock cart technology, and thousands of dead phones. Frustrated subscribers have been known to smash telephones. I hear they got that from us. The level of inefficiency, callousness, and simple insolence in the telephone exchanges would drive anyone mad, the Hindustan Times editorialized recently. But the strike was an embarrassment. Over the weekend, police and soldiers got involved. Signal Corps engineers worked without pause to repair equipment. Outside, husbands and boyfriends waited for their women. The women dropped notes complaining they were locked on the top floor, unable to eat or go to the bathroom because they refused to work. After 2.5 days, on Sunday night, the government announced the strike was over and Seti had apologized, but many strikers denied it, and so did Seti. Seti claimed the government fabricated a letter over his signature. The protests subsided on Monday, but the telephone saga went on. Seti, waving a cordless Japanese telephone, said, "In India, you just cannot get a call through." I've heard that kind of story before from India. It seems to be an ongoing struggle to make a phone call over there. So I guess you can always say that there's a part of the world where things are always worse, but that's certainly no excuse to not try and make things better, is it? That's our humorous story for this week. And we'll take some phone calls about the software piracy issue, 212-279-3400. Last week, I guess we don't really need this anymore, do we? Okay. Last week we started talking about a case that's coming out of Massachusetts involving David LaMaccia, who is being accused of running a bulletin board where people were able to copy software, download copyrighted material, and perhaps even upload copyrighted material. And he was not actually charged with software piracy, but the point I tried to bring out last week was that this very much does involve software piracy because, this whole thing would not be happening if organizations like the Software Publishers Association were not listened to so much and people didn't actually take it seriously when they say that somebody who copies a program that costs $1,000 is stealing $1,000. It's obviously something different, not necessarily saying it's a correct and proper thing to do, but to say it's analogous to stealing is just way off base as far as I'm concerned. There's an interesting article that we reprinted in this latest edition of 2600 Magazine, which itself came from the World Press Review, and it was originally printed in Malaysia. And it raises some very interesting points on software piracy. This came out well before this whole case reached the forefront. A lot of people are clamoring about the problems that we're getting from Asia, where a lot of software is copied and pirated, and to the degree where it's resold as original material, obviously that's a very bad thing. Someone is profiting from this, someone is making money off somebody else's labor, and that's something that should not be tolerated. However, there is another side to this, and that's where people simply copy software to use it or to experiment with it. That's a totally different thing. That's not selling it, making a profit off of it. That's simply gaining access to something that you would never be able to gain access to otherwise. And that's the crux of the matter. You would never be able to gain access to it otherwise. If that is the case, who is being hurt by this particular action? That's the question that we are asking here. Just to look at this particular article, and then we'll take some phone calls on the subject. This is called Software Piracy, Another View. It was written by Roberto Verzola. And as I mentioned, it was originally printed in Malaysia. And many Manila computer users copy programs from computer shops or from the computer bulletin board systems that have proliferated around the city, according to this article. They give copies of these programs to friends and colleagues, who in turn give copies to other friends and colleagues. In the terminology of Western software companies, they are pirates. Copying commercial software and giving it away to friends and colleagues is called piracy. I have seen pirates in movies, and they are a mean bunch. They are villains who steal, kill, and plunder. At the movie's endings, when these good-for-nothing pirates get their just due, the audiences invariably applaud, for the pirates get the punishment they roundly deserve. It is no fun to be called a pirate, or to be treated like one. I have seen a number of people who come from or work for Western software firms. They come and visit this country of pirates, and perhaps make a little study of how much they are losing from piracy in the Philippines. Quite a number of them, I would say, come to the country to do some pirating themselves. However, they do not pirate software. They pirate people. They pirate those who write the software. They pirate our best systems analysts, our best engineers, our best programmers, and our best computer operators. There is quite a difference between pirating intellectual property and pirating intellectuals or individuals. It cost our country perhaps $10,000 to train one doctor. Training a second doctor would cost another $10,000. Training 10 doctors would cost $100,000. In short, given an original doctor, it would cost us as much to make each copy of the original. When the Americans pirate our doctors, they take away an irreplaceable resource, where it takes more than 10 years to train a new doctor. The Philippines has approximately one doctor for every 6,700 citizens. When the U.S. pirates this doctor, it denies 6,700 Filipinos the services of a doctor. And every year, the U.S. takes away hundreds of our doctors. How many Filipinos have died because they could not get the services of a doctor in time? Now, what about a computer program? Whatever amount Lotus Corporation spent in developing its spreadsheet program, it cost practically nothing to make a second or third copy of it. When Filipinos pirate the program, they have not stolen any irreplaceable resources, nor would it take Lotus 10 years to replace the program, nor have we denied any American citizen the use of the program. It is still there for Americans to use. When the U.S. pirates our doctors, it does not take a copy and leave the original behind. Instead, it takes the original and leaves nothing behind. Copying software is a benign case of piracy. Pirating doctors is a malignant case. We have been victims of this malignant form of piracy by Western countries for a long time. They should be the last to complain when they are affected by a benign one. This piracy debate will become even more important in the future because advanced countries are now developing computer programs that can mimic what goes on in a doctor's mind. We can say with some certainty that the U.S. will raise a big row if we pirated this one program. In truth, the terms piracy and theft of intellectual property are emotionally laden, but they are not very accurate descriptions of the act. Legally, one might be charged with violating the copyright or patent laws of a country, but this would normally be different from the crime of theft or actual piracy. Using these words, however, automatically connotes immoral action on the part of the copier. Thus, in the polemics against the Third World, piracy and theft are favorite terms among advanced countries, particularly the U.S. The term piracy of individuals can likewise be used if one wants to ascribe a sense of immorality to the act. This is not to imply, of course, that countries own their intellectuals. Both intellectuals and intellectual property have other important attributes, aside from simply being commodities on the market. Notwithstanding the fact that advanced countries normally encourage the best brains of the Third World to work for them through various incentives and enticements, these intellectuals have their own reasons for doing so. Perhaps the chances for personal and professional advancement are better. Perhaps the environment is more conducive to their own temperaments and predispositions. Perhaps they are persecuted in their home countries, and so on. The Christian Bible tells of the miracle of the loaves when Jesus and his apostles had only 5 loaves of bread and 2 pieces of fish to feed 5,000 people. Every time I give away a copy of my favorite program, I remember the miracle of the loaves. Indeed, how can you be selfish if you can give things away and have more than what you started with? How can we deny a good friend if we can also keep it for ourselves? That's the view, another view of software piracy, quote-unquote. The biblical thing I thought was rather interesting. That's something that a lot of you may have a problem with, or some of you may agree with. I'd like to find out. 212-279-3400. Give us a call, and we'll see what kind of effect this thing happens on people as far as an issue for the future. Okay, let's go to the phones then. Good evening, you're on.
Yeah, hi, I just want to talk about the news.
How do you always get on the first line? That's what I want to know.
I have my ways and I...
No, how do you... Because it times out after...
I know it does, but what happens...
And yet you always wind up on the first line.
Oh, I'll explain it to you later. I don't have time to... I mean, I don't want to take the time to explain it now because I know you don't have time and you want to talk about something else.
Sure.
But I just want to know... I just want to mention something I noticed about the new 411 feature where it connects you directly to the number. I want to tell you that if you call from out of the area, you will not be able to use the connect request.
Well, yeah, I imagine it has to know where you're calling from, correct?
Yeah, but you can only use the connect request if you call from 212 or 718.
Because it's part of a 9X thing and it's part of something local, I imagine.
516 information from 212, you won't be able to, to use it.
Well, you know what? I'll bet one day you will.
You should try it.
Well, I would if I wanted to throw away money with the phone company, but...
No. You call it on a pay phone.
Mm-hmm.
And then you call 516-555-1212.
Right.
And they won't know your number. But if you call local 212 or 718, they will.
Okay. And what's the significance of that, though?
I don't know. That's what I'm asking you.
Well, I don't think it's significant, so I don't see the significance in it.
Well, you can stuff them still by, giving them... asking for credit and giving them fake phone numbers when, they want to charge you.
Mm-hmm. But you can't get connected to a number without putting money in the phone. Or making the little beeping noises they like.
No, correct? I know.
Okay. So I don't think you're really getting anything out of it, except maybe you can pretend you're somewhere you're not.
Yeah, you can, but I was wondering why that was.
It's just something that has not yet been hooked up ladder-wide, I guess.
And why isn't it hooked up when you call out of the area?
Why isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's something that they're doing on a region-by-region basis. They haven't linked the regions together yet.
System that I'm talking about.
I'm sorry?
The new system.
Right. The new system has not yet been linked up region-by-region.
Yeah, I know, but I'm calling a region that has a new system, and if you call it from out of the area, it won't give you the option of connecting directly to the number.
Right. It's because, for instance... If you call a place in another state that has caller ID, it won't necessarily pass the information along. You're calling a modern place, but the two regions have not yet been interconnected.
You know, AT&T gives a service where they can connect you with the number directly for a dollar.
Yes. Dial zero before the number, use your calling card, and you can pay through the nose just to call a phone number.
But if you call one area code in 555, you can do that.
I don't know about that. I haven't tried that. But I try not to call information since it became such a ripoff.
Right.
Write letters instead. Thanks for the call. Let's go on to somebody else. Good evening. You're on.
Oh, it's gone. Hello, Emmanuel.
Yes, go ahead.
All right, listen. The problem is that for commercial profit, in other words, a person who manufactures software and says, please, if you use our software, please pay us according to our, shall we say, terms of endearment, of usage. Then the concept is you're going to pay them because you're using it for commercial profit, and actually by using the software you'll be maximizing your personal profit. You know what I mean? So why not pay them? But there's some person who wants friends and says, look, Charlie, Jane, use my thing and make a copy of it and so forth. Now the point is, if you manufactured software, Manuel. If you were the person who had the people working, the geniuses who can figure out how to do these things, which are incredible in my estimation, and you pay rent and you pay salaries and all these different things if you're the top person,
mm-hmm.
you have a right to realize whatever fair, shall we say, fair and ethical and all these things. So, the fact that you want to feel like you're esteemed by a few of your buddies,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't give you carte blanche to abuse people who are making your life easier and profitable.
Well, I mean, I've always believed that that people are entitled to be compensated for the work they've done on a program. The thing is, I think the key word in what you're saying is fair. What is fair is fair whatever they come up with. They say a program is worth $1,000. Is that really what it's worth? When you copy it, are you, in fact, taking $1,000 from them? That's where I have trouble with the logic.
Well, the point is you may make $10,000 or $1 million using their program. Isn't that true?
If
you have endless possibilities.
Uh-huh. You may also make absolutely nothing from it. In fact, most people that copy programs don't really do anything with them. They just copy them to see what they're like, and then they forget about them.
All right. In that sense, it's not really copy for profit. It's just copy to understand and see if you can use it. But if you're realizing profits, then...
Right. Well, there's a difference between the corporate world and the individual world. In the corporate world, you use a program, and you use it for profit. You get something out of it. You're using it for your business. An individual probably isn't doing that.
Let me just show you how ridiculous the world is. You have the wheel. Somebody in ancient times conceived of, why don't I have a wheel, a round thing that rotates on an axle? And that person is not getting compensated, whether it was a man or a woman or a child who conceived of this. You understand?
Well, yeah, I think you're pointing out how ridiculous this can get.
Yeah, I mean,
absolutely.
The thing is, we should have a world where everybody does everything, you know, that has to be done, and takes care of everything. A beautiful world that I've seen the future, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And what do we have? We have Bosnians and Herzegovinians and an African situation and the American situations of Waco, Texas, and so forth. And I'll say goodnight to you and wish for the best.
Okay, thanks for calling. Yeah, it's a pretty interesting... pretty interesting point, and we have to keep looking at this from all different views, but the way it's being looked at in the corporate world, I just do not think applies to the rest of us. It just doesn't, because we just don't live by those rules. They're not human in nature. That's where I have real difficulty. Let's hear what other people have to say. 212-279-3400. Good evening, you're on.
Hello, Emmanuel?
Yes, go ahead.
Can you give me some information concerning the enhanced 911 system that NYNEX is trying to install. And I understand that it is being challenged by the ACLU as an invasion of privacy.
Well, it's enhanced 911 allows the police department to get all kinds of information when you call them. It's got nothing to do with caller ID. It's a separate system. They get your when you call them, they get the number showing up on their screen. They also get your name. They can see a detailed map of your house if you've given them that information, that is, including if there's any hazardous material stored in a certain area, perhaps a file that they have on you where they've noted if you've called before and what you've said and that kind of thing. So basically, you call them, and a little screen pops up and shows them all kinds of data about you. It's basically advertised as a way to make things safe for everybody, because if you call the police and you can't speak or something like that and you need help, they'll know where to go. And I guess, you know, it's also an invasion of privacy in some ways. But again, you know, if you don't want this to happen, you just don't call 911. You call the non-emergency number. I think it only becomes a real invasion of privacy when this kind of information is passed on calls that you don't know it's being passed on. You see, if everybody knows it, yeah, I don't really see it as an invasion that much. What do you think? Are you there?
Well, the only reason I raised that question was because of the fact...
Uh-huh.
...was because it was brought up at a precinct council meeting last night by the New York telephone company NYNEX telephone representative, as well as the police at a police meeting. And then finally they came out with the information when I that the ACLU had... there's anything really to be concerned about as far as our rights under the Constitution.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's right to be concerned. We have to always look to see if there's any little hidden provisions in there.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Right. For instance, any kind of information being stored about us that they really have no right to know.
Yeah.
And that's why it's important to take a good look at these systems and see just what it is they're doing, how they work.
Yeah, they're very vague about it.
Uh-huh. Well, that you can't... Okay, that means there's something wrong with the whole system then. If they're not telling you things about a system that
no,
you're going
to
be paying
for.
No,
they're trying to tell you, you know, in case somebody needs care like you were suggesting before, that might be, you know, it make it easier for someone to get through to 911 in spite of the fact that they could not speak or whatever, the police would be able to locate where the person was calling from, etc.
Right. Well, I mean, that's... If they're not telling you something, you have to persist until they do.
Most of us don't know what to ask.
Right.
But the only reason that I'm calling you about it is because of the fact that in the course of the conversation, he indicated about the ACLU challenging it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to proceed further. I wanted to know if this is official, already installed. Does somebody have to vote on it, or do our legislators, or whatever it takes to get something passed?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is something that has to be...
You think?
It has to be approved by the Public Service Commission.
It has to be approved by the Public Service Commission.
Right, and ultimately, the Public Service Commission is supposed to respond to what people here say.
I see. In other words, would you suggest that I, since I am very much interested in our rights of privacy, discuss it with whether or not this will come before our community board.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I think it's something.
Or do you think I'm kind of making a mountain out of a mole?
Well, look at it this way: once this thing is installed, you will never get rid of it. So I think you owe it to everybody to make sure that it's exactly what you want. And if it's not exactly what you want, have them tailor it to something that you do want. And the way to do that is to learn as much as there is to learn about it, and maybe go out and see one in action and see exactly how it does work, and perhaps make suggestions as to how it could be better, or say that you don't want these particular things to be known about people in your area.
Yeah.
That's the only way, you know, because people don't do that. That's why we have things show up. And,
so
that
right
we don't
away
want.
They cloak it up with making it easier about the person who can't speak for that, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
Right, just like the Clipper chip will protect all of us against terrorists. It's
yeah,
not necessarily
that's right.
So.
So that's why I'm raising the question, but you say it has to be approved by the public service.
To the best of my knowledge, that's true. To the best of my knowledge, but then again, they always make it as confusing as possible so people won't
the
challenge
belief,
it.
Yeah,
yeah, but I would go under that assumption.
I was the only one that challenged it at a meeting maybe of at least 100 people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you did, because we have to always, even if something is right, they have to be able to tell you why it's right. You
yeah.
See?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's right for the telephone company. If there's a revenue involved and all that, mm-hmm. you know, that they may be getting from taxpayers or from the city for, you know, in cooperation, maybe working with the police.
Yeah, well, there's always revenue in it for the phone company.
Absolutely.
That's
I raise the question if they want to, if they think that this might be an easier way to track down drug trafficker, you know.
Right.
Drug guys and dealers out there that the telephone company do away with all these six or seven or more telephones on every block in the Midtown area,
uh-huh.
and in the business areas, so you know, we don't need all those phones.
Mm-hmm.
What for? Because it's only revenue for the telephone company.
Well, it's nice to have phones that work, but I don't know if that's high on
the list. But a lot of these phones are connected outside of stores,
right.
Which I understand the stores actually own the phones or whatever it is. And
yeah.
They're used by the drug dealers.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, phones are phones. They're going to be used by all kinds of people, and you don't solve a problem by getting rid of the phones.
Well, you just give more opportunity for drug dealers to do their business on the streets.
Well, I mean, drug dealers will always have cellular phones. You can't outlaw those. I think we need to look at the bigger problem. It's not the phones. It's the fact that that people have to sell drugs. People feel they have to sell drugs. We shouldn't have a society where that kind of thing is necessary in anybody's mind.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call.
Okay.
And good
Thank
luck.
You.
Keep us informed. Take care. 212-279-3400. Always good to question authority wherever possible. Good evening, you're on.
All right, hang on.
How are you?
Hi. Am I on the air?
Yes, you are. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I was because of the issue that you have at hand, like everybody else. I wanted to talk to you about Romania. A few years back, I remember you came on the air and you said you went to Romania. I don't know why.
Uh-huh. A curiosity, mostly.
Well, I went there this spring, last month, as a matter of fact. After 12 years, I left Romania in 1982 and I moved here.
Uh-huh.
Became a citizen anyway. I went there to visit after 12 years and shocked is the least that I could say about the place.
What shocked you?
Well, basically, like you said, no lights on the streets, missing manhole covers, you know. It looked like, well, first of all, when I landed on the airport, there were like hundreds of soldiers with machine guns ready and armored vehicles on the tarmac.
Uh-huh.
I thought we landed in Yugoslavia by mistake.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't like that in 1982 with the dim streetlights and everything?
No, no. When I left Romania, Bucharest was, like 10 times cleaner than New York City on its best day.
Uh-huh.
And it was well lit. And the problem then was that people had no, nothing to buy. They had money in their pockets.
Right.
They were starving with the money in their pockets. Now, they have no money, and, the stores are full of food and
mm-hmm.
so on and so forth, but nobody can afford. And which brings me to my next point about their phone system over there.
Okay.
Which is like a joke. First of all, it's like really noisy. There's like a huge background noise when you're talking on the phone. It after 10 minutes of talking, your ear literally hurts.
Really?
From listening. I don't know what. And they have no touchtone. It's all pulse, I think.
Uh-huh.
And
that's true in a lot of countries.
The other thing is that the inflation rate is so high that the coins that you use for the phone are so worthless that nobody has them in the stores to give them to you. Or they won't exchange money, bigger denominations for these coins. So you can't use a public phone over there.
Are the coins regular currency or are they special phone coins?
Regular coins, but they're like uh-huh. like a penny. And they're not like we have our... Their worth is about a penny, but they're not like we have pennies here. You know, there's pennies over here with the tons, but over there they don't even have them. Like the smallest coin is about 50 lei.
Uh-huh.
And you usually can't find this coin. Usually the smallest one that people carry is 100. And the 100 doesn't fit in the slots for the phones.
So people can't use the phones at all?
No. And I mean, the phones, if you look at them on the street, they look like, they don't look like they work. But if you pick it up, you'll get a tone.
Uh-huh.
But they actually work. They just look, everything looks in a total state of disrepair. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's a scary place, too.
Even though it looks so bad, I mean, there's plenty of Camel cigarette advertisements. They went so far as to paint the Camel logo in yellow light on the traffic lights.
You're kidding.
No, the Camel bought the rights, I guess, whatever they did.
The yellow traffic lights? That's amazing.
The light turns, it's red, and then it turns yellow, and then green, or green, and then yellow.
Uh-huh.
When it turns yellow, you see Camel written, and then the Camel, you know.
But you have to be looking directly at the light, right? Or does it cast some sort of a shadow?
No. You're looking right at the light,
uh-huh.
you know, as you're waiting in traffic to drive, you know. And you look at the light, you see, when the light turns yellow, you see Camel.
Yeah, because in many places, New York is not one of them, many places a red light will be, it'll change to yellow before it changes back to green.
Right, here it changes
right.
from red directly to green.
Right, so in many cases you'd be sitting in traffic just staring at the light, waiting for it to change, and then all of a sudden it changes, and what do you see? You see Joe Camel. So he'll be, paralleled with being allowed to go, being allowed to proceed, something good.
Right. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So you go out and have a smoke. That's what they want you to do. That's something. That's something how we manage to advertise in places that need so much
to them,
more.
You guys have even surpassed us, and, you know, we have the heart of advertising is here in the United States, and even we haven't done such a thing, you know.
Uh-huh.
They said, their attitude is like everybody wants to do some kind of deal, some kind of business. They all want to come over here, and, you know, they were asking all my my friends were asking me, oh, come on, we should start something, we should do something. We,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have suits, we have shoes. We have... I said, you people are nuts. I said, there's shoes and suits in America that you know, nobody wants to buy, and you want to come over there. With... I said, you know,
mm-hmm.
they have no idea. I think what happened was that unlike Hungary and Czechoslovakia and these other Eastern Bloc countries, after they had their revolutions, all these companies went in there and moved in and they pumped in a lot of money into their economies. Because unlike Romania, these other countries had some type of industry that was actually putting some kind of product out before. So it was worthwhile for the American companies or the Western companies to invest. But in Romania, nothing was working, and nobody right. went there.
Well, Ceausescu was simply obsessed with paying off the national debt, and it starved the entire country. And you're seeing the effects today, and for many years, you'll probably still see the effects.
Yeah, so as a result, nobody went in there, and the place is in the state that it... I mean, it, literally, you, walking down the street at night, you have to be extremely careful because you cannot see... where you're going. Then the other thing is, I've seen these buildings that Ceausescu started building.
The House of the People.
Right, around that area over there.
Uh-huh.
He also built, like, many projects, and they were left unfinished, you know. The building
right.
looks like it's unfinished, an unfinished building.
Huge buildings, yeah.
But surprisingly, to really shock you, is like in the middle of this building at night, you'll see a light lit up in an apartment that actually people live there.
Uh-huh.
It's like the only apartment that's lit up in the whole building. And somebody lives there. It looks like a totally, you know, blown out building. Like no windows in some of the places.
Uh-huh.
And people actually live there. Now, from what my relatives told me is that they bought apartments in there, but they have no water. You know, the elevators don't work and stuff like that.
Well, it's a society gone mad, unfortunately. Hopefully something will happen in the near future. Sir, we strayed way off the topic, but we're going to have to move on to another subject.
All right, great.
All
listen,
right.
I like your show a lot, and I listen to it all the time, even though some of the times I don't understand most of the things you talk about, but the spirit of it is what is very captivating.
That's it, absolutely.
All
thanks
right,
very
thanks
much.
Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
It's very interesting to think about that place, which is about as alien as you can get, going over to a foreign country like that and just seeing a whole different mentality, a whole different way of looking at things and everything. Literally everything we take for granted here is just something totally different over there. So technology is something that doesn't even enter into it at that point. The thing that really frightens me is, what if a place like that had high technology and was able to use it against the people like everything else was used against the people? That's something that we always have to be vigilant about, because, as we mentioned, technology is something that doesn't go away once you invent something. It's always going to be there. So that's why we have to think very carefully if we want to introduce new forms of it. All right, let's go back to the phones and go back to the topic of technology, I guess. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hey, finally got through.
Yeah, and I think you deafened a lot of people, too.
Oh, that's odd.
Okay, so what's up?
Sorry about that. Well, first of all, I'm calling you from a Plantronics headset, which is a really fabulous convenience.
Oh, it's a good sound quality, I'll say that, just a bit loud.
Oh, gee, sorry. There is a knob, but I'd have to spend a little time to...
No, it's okay. Our engineers have adjusted for the
okay.
sound boost there.
Groovy. You know, I was one of the exchanges that got the call return and the busy buster function before it was documented and advertised.
Repeat call, yes.
Right. And now I use those features all the time, and I don't seem to be charged for it. Ever.
I think you probably are somewhere. You look in your bill, it doesn't say anything?
Well, I'll tell you, my girlfriend, who's also in Brooklyn,
uh-huh.
gets a little thing in her bill saying you used this feature this many times, and it's 75 cents a pop.
Right.
I don't get anything like that.
Do you subscribe? Do you subscribe to the feature itself? Because if you do, you get charged a set amount no matter how many times you use it.
Right, and that would be documented on my bill.
It would be, but not as prominently.
Well, but it's not. I mean, I inspect my bill.
Uh-huh.
They haven't tacked anything onto my custom package, you know, which includes touch tone. Right.
How long have you had this service?
Since I heard it on your show.
Really?
You first started, yeah.
Well, that's something. Maybe in fact you are. I mean, this is a company that mails out calling cards and tells people to keep them secret and prints this as your phone bill in envelopes where it's not your phone bill. So it's possible they could make a mistake.
Yeah, but, I think so.
But if I were you, I would not tell anybody where you're calling from because they'll fix it right away if you.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was wondering what would I do if you asked me.
Yeah. Well, no, I would never ask something like that.
You know what? I decided that I would actually tell you.
No, don't tell me. Don't tell anybody.
No, you're not asking, and I'm not telling, and I'm glad you're not asking.
I will not ask a question like that, because that's private information, you know? Who am I to pry?
That's right.
Right. So anything else on your mind?
Yeah, a couple of things. About the piracy issue, I really like that editorial. And I think, to get just slightly philosophical here.
Okay.
The concepts of ownership that we assume, or that many people assume, are sort of givens, are really more a product of technology. They're not the absolutes that some people are led to believe. You know, we have had years of a given technology. Copyright was really built around print. And now that there's new technology, people are trying to cram the old issue of ownership, make it fit.
Exactly.
This new world. And it's, I hope, I don't have a lot of faith in this, but I hope that the thinking about this will slowly evolve.
Yeah, it just doesn't match. You know, the old thinking does not match with the new ways because
it's
different.
It's
totally different.
It's really hard to get out of it. I think something that we all do.
Every time you hear the word theft or stealing software, you have to correct the person and say that's not what the definition says. Stealing is when you remove something. And you're not removing something when you copy something. It's different, and maybe it's wrong in some way, but it's not theft.
I think it's going to take a long time for that to change, and we have years of laws that are on the books.
Yeah, I just hope people don't get sent to prison for copying files. I mean, although people already have. Len Rose was sent to prison for just such a thing.
Who was?
Just another person for copying supposedly AT&T software. Actually, a few people have been sent to prison for things like that. Things that could not have benefited them in any way, but AT&T or other companies said that they were worth millions of dollars. So therefore, to an uninformed judge, it seems like this person is stealing millions of dollars. So there's a real problem with that kind of thinking. It can be misinterpreted, and people can wind up suffering for it.
Right.
And the software companies are not the people that are suffering.
There was another thing on my mind. I don't know if we have enough time for it. And you have to tell me if you decide this is irrelevant.
Okay.
Years ago, I worked for General Telephone in California.
Okay.
Many years ago. And I discovered a few things. They're not really valid today. This is kind of like a nostalgia trip. But they really stuck with me. One of them was the phone man's handset, phone person's handset, which has special alligator clips designed with kind of a pincushion contact, which enables you to clamp onto a phone wire without leaving a trace that you clamped there. Can you picture what I'm saying? Are you familiar with this?
Well, yeah. You sort of stick it into the mesh of wires?
You stick it into one clamp to each of the skinny pair of wires that applies to one phone number.
Well, the idea is you don't make any noise when you spy on a conversation.
Not only do you not make any noise, but you don't make any physical dent in the insulation that anyone can see.
Right, and you don't draw any voltage. In other words, if nobody's on the phone, you don't get a dial tone. You just get a hum until an incoming call comes in.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, those are used by the phone company quite a bit to test lines. But of course, they can be used for all kinds of nefarious purposes as well.
Right, and that's exactly why it stuck with me.
Uh-huh.
And another thing that happened, which may be even more esoteric and maybe not of interest to you, I was hired like as a summer job, and one of the things we were doing was running cables to provide phone service for a marina. And the wire was such that to strip the insulation off, there's no way you could do it without getting a lot of like tar and grease on your hands. In other words, this was the kind of primitive technology that could defeat someone who had one of these handsets, for instance.
Yeah.
And it just occurred to me, okay, maybe this is a great cable because it goes underwater and it's really durable, but boy, you know, it seems like a highly secure cable as well. I don't know if you've heard of any other such things.
Well, it's not the first time I've heard something similar to that. But we're out of time, unfortunately, so I'm afraid you have the last word tonight as far as this kind of thing goes. Thanks for the stories. Thanks for the comments.
Sure. Great show.
Okay. Take care.
Okay.
And yes, we're out of time once again. This is Off the Hook, and we'll be back again next Wednesday night at 10 o'clock talking about probably some other issue that has come up, because issues are always coming up in this world. I've noticed that. If you want to write to us, our address is Off the Hook, care of WBAI, 505 8th Avenue, New York, New York, 10018. We do like to see all kinds of interesting news items, stories, such as the one from India, and anything else that you feel might be an issue that you'd like us to discuss. Please send it on in, and we'll look at everything that that we get. Stay tuned for a rebroadcast of the evening news. This is WBAI, New York. Good night.
In the news tonight, President Clinton calls on NATO to expand its role in Bosnia. He hints he wants ground troops sent in. The House of Representatives speaks out on race and the death penalty. And in New York, gays and lesbians take on the New York Post while vendors take on the mayor. With these and other stories, I'm Jose Santiago in New York with Verna Avery Brown in Washington. And this is the news for Wednesday, April 20, 1994. First to Washington for the Pacifica National News.
NATO has given tentative approval to broadening airstrikes in Bosnia to include the six safe havens. A final decision has been delayed pending advice from the military. In Garajda, Bosnian Serbs are continuing to bombard the town. This morning, shells were hitting at the rate of one per minute. Earlier today, the director of the main hospital said Serb tanks were only 100 yards away and firing directly at the hospital. In his words, this is not a war anymore, it's slaughter, massacre. UN workers say at least 10 people are dead and more than 15 wounded after three rockets hit the hospital. Elsewhere in Bosnia, Serbs released some of the UN observers who'd been detained after last week's airstrikes on Garajda. And Serb troops returned 18 anti-aircraft guns seized yesterday near Sarajevo. Human rights groups are charging the Peruvian military is indiscriminately killing civilians in its latest offensive against the Shining Path. Doug Stinson reports from Lima.
Accounts are trickling out of the Huallaga Valley in central Peru that civilians are being targeted in the Peruvian army's assault on Shining Path strongholds. Survivors say helicopter gunships are firing on villages, and ground troops are torturing campesinos caught in the fray. The National Human Rights Coordinator, an umbrella organization of Peruvian human rights groups, has taken testimony from eyewitnesses, indicating as many as 100 people have been killed by Peruvian military forces over the last week. There has been no official comment from the Peruvian government. The International Red Cross and other independent observers have been denied access to the combat area, previously considered to be in rebel hands. The Shining Path is said to control drug traffic in the Huallaga Valley, the center of Peruvian cocaine production. The human rights coordinator will release detailed testimony tomorrow, but is withholding the identity of the eyewitnesses out of concern for their safety. For Pacifica Network News, this is Douglas Stinson in Lima.
The Clinton administration wants to show it's stepping up enforcement of safety regulations. This week, the Labor Department issued one of its largest fines. It charged a tire company failed to follow proper safety procedures for maintenance workers, resulting in the death of one worker and the maiming of several others. In response, the Oklahoma tire factory shut down rather than obey a Labor Department directive aimed at improving its safety procedures. A court restraining order on the Labor Department directive led the company to allow workers back for last night's 11 o'clock shift. Carrie Hulsey reports from Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City Dayton tire plant workers are back on the job. The plant shut down Monday afternoon after an announcement by U.S. Secretary of Labor Robert Reich declaring the plant an imminent danger to employees and fining the company $7.5 million for safety violations. The fine and Reich's visit to Oklahoma City were prompted by the investigation into a worker's death last October. The judge says evidence concerning Dayton's compliance to OSHA safety regulations will be heard in open court. The trial is set to begin May 10th. For Pacifica Network News, I'm Carrie Holsey in Oklahoma City.
A new study on breast cancer backs previous research that removing a lump can be at least as effective as removing the entire breast. Published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the study of nearly 6,000 breast cancer patients found women who had a lumpectomy or removal of lumps plus radiation were at least as likely to survive 5 years as women who had a mastectomy or complete removal of the breast. A 1990 report had encouraged lumpectomies but had used some fraudulent data. And those are the stories topping the news. The death penalty took center stage in the debate on the national crime bill. By a tiny margin, the House kept alive a measure that would allow the use of statistics in detecting whether the death penalty is being meted out unfairly to African Americans. And today's debate was typical of the highly partisan battle that is brewing over the issue. Pacifica's Don Rush has this report.
The crime bill adds nearly 70 new capital offenses to the federal law books, and they raise fears that the death penalty would weigh even more heavily on minorities in this country. So today, black and Hispanic lawmakers pushed hard for what is called the Racial Justice Act. The measure would allow a judge to use statistics to determine if the death penalty were being sought in a racially discriminatory manner. Democrats did make one concession on the floor. They agreed not to make the measure retroactive, a complaint heard often from Republicans. On the floor, House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt fought for votes. He told his colleagues that the act was necessary for the American people to have faith in their legal system.
Keep their faith. Allow there to be a proper inquiry into discriminatory practices in the death penalty.
But Republicans charged that the measure was an attempt to end the death penalty. Critics note that African Americans make up the bulk of those facing capital punishment on the federal level. But Connecticut Representative Gary Franks, the only black Republican in the House, said this did not justify what he called a quota system.
What do we tell that mother whose child was murdered, Mr. Chairman? I'm sorry, Mrs. Jones. If a white man had been accused of killing your daughter, he would be subject to the death penalty. But a black man was charged with the murder, and because there are too many blacks on death row, it would be difficult to give him the death penalty if convicted.
But that was not very convincing to D.C. delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton.
There is no check on the prosecutor today. He chooses blacks for death. Allowing the defendant to try to show that that is the case is the only check on him. Do not turn your backs on documented racism.
When the dust settled, the Racial Justice Act had withstood the assault, unlike last year. The record of the crime bill is mixed at best. The House has expanded the so-called three strikes and you're out provision. That measure would send a criminal defendant to life in prison without parole on a third violent offense. Under Republican prodding, the House version allows one of those strikes to be a serious drug conviction. Efforts to streamline the right of appeal were also withdrawn after conservatives expressed fear that it might eliminate the death penalty. The reason? The measure required top-notch legal representation for criminal defendants. Said Michigan Democrat John Conyers, an influential member of the Black Caucus, we're in an era of very mean-spirited attitudes about getting tough. There's no doubt that politics is playing a key role in the ongoing battle, and it is clear that the president has stolen a classic Republican issue. And Republicans have been frustrated, complaining that Clinton and the Democrats have not gone far enough. Indeed, Arkansas Democrat Blanche Lampert noted that she had gotten her hands on a memo from one Republican who recommended his colleagues vote against.